Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on air. On tonight's program, Emerging Trends in Orthopedics, with the president of the American Board of Orthopedic Surgery.
A great example of that is shoulder surgery, where many, many things are now done arthroscopically that were done open in the past.
Plus, a woman whose commitment to fitness has made her into an iron girl.
The biggest thing was I knew I had to work on my swimming, but I've seen myself from beginning to end. I knew I could, if I put myself up to the challenge, I could prepare for it.
And a conversation about kids and bullying.
There tends to be an imbalance of power between the individuals who are being bullied and the bullier. So the person doing the bullying is in a higher position of power.
We'll get an update on food labels and hear from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll explore one woman's quest for fitness as she becomes an iron girl. Plus, we'll learn all you need to know about bullying and the dangers to all involved. But first, what are the latest trends in orthopedic surgery? Technological innovations are changing the face of all aspects of medicine today. And here with more on some of the latest trends in the field of orthopedic surgery is Dr. Stephen Albanese. He's professor and chair of orthopedic surgery at Upstate Medical University, and he is the president of the American Board of Orthopedic Surgery as well. Welcome, Dr. Albanese. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So orthopedics, like so many fields in medicine, has to be experiencing a lot of technological advances. I mean, there's so much happening in imaging these days and all kinds of, you know, trends in terms of doing less with more or doing more with less, frankly. What's happening in terms of things like imaging? How has imaging changed orthopedics today?
Well, I think that as technology has advanced, the quality of the images have continued to advance. And technology and technology companies are always looking for ways for us to better image what's going on, a way for us to see inside of people. An example that a lot of people are familiar with, of course, is the MRI, and MRIs have come into common usage. And as the technology has advanced, the resolution has continued to increase and allows us to better make diagnoses.
And also, does it help you prepare for surgery, and as a result, maybe the outcomes of surgery are improved and maybe the length of, you know, recoup time is shortened? Is that all true too?
Well, I think it helps you a lot in preparation so that you know what you're going to have to face when you get into surgery, so that you can get a good glimpse inside of a joint to help you prepare for what you're going to have to do. And not only for the surgeon to prepare, but the patients themselves can be prepared. They have a better idea of what is going to be found at surgery and what their rehabilitation course is going to be afterwards.
How about things like it's in the research world? I know I've been hearing things like 3D implants. I mean, what are those? And again, that's a technological advance. What are they trying to accomplish and what are they?
There are ways to try to make joint implants or other types of implants for patients fit more precisely to the individual patient. Some patients are, we're all different anatomically, so the more precise that you can make an implant anatomically, theoretically, the better it will do. I think that this is in its infancy, but I think a lot of listeners have probably seen examples of 3D printers for a variety of reasons becoming commonplace, and that is certainly being explored in several aspects of medicine, including orthopedic surgery.
So that whole idea of using a computer to generate an actual joint and create a joint that you could then replace that's more customized to the individual.
That's how you would tie in both imaging advancements and just advancements in technology in creating implants. You can get a more precise idea of the anatomy from the advancements of imaging, and then you can translate that into an implant that fits a patient more accurately. Mm-hmm. Now, these things, again, are still in their infancy and not in common usage yet. But certainly as you look down the road, you can see these things coming, and you can see looking back how many things have changed over the past 30 years.
Yeah, speaking of that, I read somewhere, you know, there's all this buzz about stem cells. That's the buzzword. And that there's some attempt at this point to even use stem cells to repair joints. That seems like a new field, a new horizon.
Cartilage is a tremendous challenge for orthopedic surgery, and anybody that has any type of arthritis knows how painful arthritis is. And arthritis really is damaging to the cartilage. And we have lots of good ways to repair bones and get bones to heal, but cartilage is a challenge. And using stem cells or cartilage transplants of a variety of type is a promising field. Again, there are some things that are in clinical use at this point, not advanced to the point where you could correct advanced arthritis, but certainly there is some promise in this field. You know, in the long run, that would be the ideal way to fix a joint rather than replace it with a mechanical or metallic plastic implant to replace it with normal tissue.
That would be ideal.
Durable. That would be ideal, yes.
Yeah, and it's true. That kind of promise is being held out for a lot of disease entities where stem cells could play a role in actually regenerating or generating new organs even. So stem cells really are on the cutting edge, I guess. How about things like minimally invasive techniques? I know that orthopedic surgery has really been at the forefront of utilizing those kinds of things like arthroscopy even for years now.
It's been very interesting to watch the evolution of this over the past several years. Things that were commonly done as an open procedure in the hospital are now commonly done in the outpatient setting. The advancements in arthroscopy and the instruments that allow repair inside the joints has been amazing. A great example of that is shoulder surgery, where many, many things are now done arthroscopically that were done open in the past. Knee is the most common thing that people are probably familiar with. Knee arthroscopy, knee repair has been around for a long time. But really, many joints are now being approached arthroscopically, and it's really a benefit to the patients to not have to have things opened in a more elaborate procedure.
They have a much shorter recovery time, I would think, and less problems with infection, all kinds of other potential outcomes.
Yes.
Potential complications.
It facilitates the post-surgical recovery, less painful for people, less invasive overall.
And with that, haven't you moved a lot within orthopedic surgery to more outpatient types of procedures versus the whole idea of that long hospital stay?
There has been a big shift in orthopedic surgery through the years to the outpatient setting, and that shift continues. There was a time when even minor hand procedures were done as an inpatient. Now, just about all hand surgery is done in the outpatient setting. Much of the shoulder surgery is done outpatient. And there is a move to do rapid turnaround in some types of joint replacements. They're 24-hour stays or outpatient joint replacements or partial joint replacements that are being done. So this trend continues. There are some spine procedures now that are
really?
Done outpatient, simple discectomies or some minor cervical spine neck procedures are done as outpatient now. So
wow.
I see the trend continuing. And it allows the patients to be able to go home the same day. It's just a much more manageable situation for people.
In general, it seems like the recovery, as I said, and all the sequelae, and also for costs. It seems like it helps keep costs down to do it on an outpatient basis.
The outpatient setting is more cost effective.
So now you're currently serving as the president of the American Board of Orthopedic Surgery. What do you do? Tell us about that role. Is it a one-year term?
It's a one-year term as president. The American Board of Orthopedic Surgery is the body that certifies orthopedic surgeons nationally. And so our role is really to oversee that process, to set standards, to approve candidates to become board certified.
Has the crop of orthopedics kids who want to become orthopedic surgeons, has it changed? Do you see anything, you know, different from that purview that you have overlooking the entire thing?
I think that we have for a long time and continue to get very qualified applicants to our residency programs, and I see that trend continuing. So there are some very high-quality people that come through.
Has the process of certification changed?
The process of certification has changed. Not so much the initial process of certification, but the continuing certification of people. There was a time up to about 1986, where in orthopedic surgery, you could get a lifetime certificate in orthopedic surgery.
Wow.
And then that was changed, and the certificates are time-limited in orthopedic surgery, as they are in all the other medical specialties under the American Board of Medical Specialties. And that process started as a simple recertification process, but now it is more of a continuing education program in addition to having to recertify at the conclusion of every 10-year cycle.
So that it's not an automatic recertification, that you have to actually demonstrate a certain amount of continuing medical education credits or efforts that have been made to continue to grow in your profession.
You have to demonstrate continuing medical education credits. You have to do some self-assessment activities. And then at the end of the 10-year cycle, you have to take some type of examination.
Really?
In orthopedic surgery, it's either a computer-based written examination or an oral examination based on your own cases.
So this year, this was a one-year term, am I correct?
Yes, it's one-year term as a president, but serving on the board that oversees certifying for orthopedic surgery is a 10-year term.
Oh, so have you been on the board prior to this presidency?
This is my seventh year as president.
Oh, okay.
Year on the board, yes.
So you have a lot of experience. Yeah. So give us just a little bit of time we have left. What do you see as the major challenges facing the field of orthopedics or the training of orthopods?
Well, I think that the field of orthopedics, the challenge is really keeping up with the advancements and the technological changes that continue to occur, and to continue to explore the best ways to make our patients more functional. We have a very, very active society now. People are staying active longer. It affects their joints. They have issues that come to our attention, musculoskeletal issues, and trying to find the best way to properly serve our patients in a safe and effective manner.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think with the aging population, all aspects of medicine are being challenged as to how to keep people active longer. And clearly, orthopedics is right on the front line of all of that. Well, thanks very much for coming in. Your term will end in how many months?
It's going to end at the beginning of October.
Okay, well, I apparently it's been a very gratifying experience for you if you've been continuing to be on the board. So thanks so much for coming in and sharing all this perspective with us. It's a very nice purview to have on the whole field. My guest has been Dr. Stephen Albanese, professor and chair of orthopedic surgery at Upstate Medical University and the current president of the American Board of Orthopedic Surgery. Next up, one woman's quest for fitness as an Iron Girl. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. The Iron Girl event is an opportunity for women of all ages to come together as a community, to be fit, to be healthy, and to celebrate the joy of living. This year saw the 6th annual Iron Girl event in Syracuse, and here with more on this and to share her own personal experience is Heather Nelson. She's a graduate student in cell and developmental biology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Heather. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
So first, tell us about this Iron Girl event. What is it, and what's its mission?
The Iron Girl is a sprint triathlon, so you have a swim, bike, and run. It's a shorter version of the Iron Man, and it's basically a way to bring women together and foster the ability of women to compete in these types of events and to finish. And it's, they're very supportive. There's all volunteers. No matter what your fitness level is, they encourage you and try to help you get to the finish line.
So this is a triathlon, and I maybe for some of our listeners may not understand. Tell us a little bit more about the components of a triathlon in this case.
A triathlon starts with a swim. This one happened to be a 600-meter swim, but there's a range depending on the race you're doing. After you get done with the swim, you immediately get onto your bike and go out for a bike ride. In the Iron Girl, it was a 30K bike ride. And then once you get back from the bike, you hop off and you start running. And in this case, it was a 5K run.
Wow. And I think the very astounding news, and I already knew this before we sat down, is that you had quite a finish here. You ended up as fourth out of how many people?
Yes, there was, I think, a total of just over 1,100 wow. Women that competed that day.
And I might add, this was the very first time you did a triathlon.
Yes, it was my first attempt at the triathlon.
Unbelievable. Well, we have a lot more to talk about how you got here, but what prompted you to choose to do this triathlon at this time?
Well, I had always been kind of interested. I had heard of them. I'd seen a little bit about them, and I've always been into activity. I've been a runner since I was probably about 12. The lab I got into, the PI, is really into biking, so he kind of drew me into the biking world.
The PI meaning the principal investigator of your laboratory.
Okay. Yeah. So between the running and the biking, I had two components of the triathlon, and I'm always looking for a new challenge as well. So I decided it's time to give one a try. And then the Upstate Women's Health Network was looking for some women from upstate to sponsor for this event, and I decided, what better time?
Wow. So the timing was right, and this challenge was something that was new for you, but you have, as we said, a lot of experience in fitness or in doing physical activity. When you were in high school, or you said at age 12 you started running, what kinds of experiences did you have?
Yeah, my first experience with running was on the track team. I started in seventh grade. I always ran distance on the track team, but I was also active in soccer and basketball throughout school. And even before starting at probably age 10, I started soccer and basketball. So there's a lot of running in those sports, too, that kept me active.
So you really had some good foundation. But how about the swimming? Had you done anything like that?
No. I've always been a weak swimmer. The most swimming I did is at the summers at a little lake or something. But I didn't actually go to swim. I just kind of,
paddled around.
Yeah, dog paddled. So yeah. That was the biggest challenge for me.
What made you feel that you could do this? What thought occurred to you that I can do this?
Just my level of activity. I knew I had a strong foundation that would help me to the finish. The biggest thing was I knew I had to work on my swimming, but I've seen myself from beginning to end. I knew I could, if I put myself up to the challenge, I could prepare for it.
It sounds like the kinds of things you've done, though, in your professional life as well as a student, you've devoted yourself toward a certain field, and a certain dedication comes with that. So perhaps that kind of goes together, that kind of determination and dedication.
Yeah, I think a large part of it is I tend to have a lot of drive to finish things and to push myself beyond what I think I can do. So.
And what are you doing in cell and developmental biology right now?
I'm working in a lab that's basic research towards looking for a treatment or cure for type 2 diabetes. Basically, we're looking at a proteins that may be involved in regulating insulin secretion.
Wow. And you have how much longer to go with this whole project? I mean, not just the project, but with your education.
I probably have about 2 to 3 years left. I just started my third year, and it's typically 5 to 6 years total.
To finish a doctorate?
Yes.
And then what do you hope to do after that?
I'm really not sure at this point yet. I'm still trying to explore the different areas I could go, whether I want to go into academia or into industry or even a host of other fields. I haven't decided.
But research is the area that you want to remain part of.
Yeah, definitely research.
Be a researcher. If you're just joining us or listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, I'm Linda Cohen here with graduate student Heather Nelson. She's a recent participant in the 6th annual Iron Woman Triathlon event, and we're talking about the race and her experience. So why is exercise important to you?
For me, exercise is a great way to relieve stress, clear my mind. I spend long hours in the lab, so it's a good way just to get away from that for a little while.
For me, it's a lot of fun. I feel a lot better after I do it. It gives me another bounce of energy. So,
do you see, I think you had said to me at one point that there are some people who are less active. You think is there the next generation, maybe because they're so tied to their various electronic devices, and you have some feeling about that in terms of exercise?
I think there's it seems like a growing issue with less activity among the kids. They're, instead of being as active, like you said, they're kind of tied to the electronics. So I think by setting an example of how fun exercise can be, pull other kids in. I know my nephew is a great example. He loves to come watch me. He actually watched my triathlon and told me he wants to do one now. So I feel like it's setting a good example for...
You're a good inspiration there. What about the social aspects? Have you made friends doing this, or do you have friends who are physically very active as well?
Yes, definitely. I've met a lot of people. Coming to Syracuse, I knew nobody, and then I've met a lot of people through both running and through soccer, which I play a few times a week.
What area do you call home? Where did you come from?
I've been in New York, so upstate New York, for about 10 years, but prior to coming to Syracuse, I was in Northville, New York, which is a tiny town in the southern end of the Adirondack Park.
Wow. So would you call yourself a mountain girl?
For part of my time. Previous to that, though, I lived in California, so...
Oh, wow. So you've been on both coasts, so to speak. How do you stay in shape? What do you do to stay in shape on a regular basis?
I run just about every day, typically in the morning before coming into lab. I'll get a run in. Usually in the weekdays, it's just 3 to 4 miles. Occasionally, I'll do one after lab as well.
Do you do this year-round?
Yes.
Wow. So
I'm a little worse about it in the winter because it's super cold, but I typically move to going after lab once it gets to be really cold because it's a little warmer then.
And so you run once or twice a day. That's pretty intense. And do you also do other activities?
Yeah, I also bike to and from the lab most of the year. And then, like, I've started to, instead of going just straight home and straight to the lab, just a direct route, I'll try to kind of wander around to lengthen my ride a little bit because a direct route's only about 3 miles.
How about playing sports? Is that something that you continue to do? I know you mentioned that you were doing that as a younger person.
Yes, I still play soccer. I haven't played basketball in a while, but I play soccer 2 to 3 times a week in some indoor leagues in the area.
And do you need to do that? I mean, are you planning or are you thinking about continuing this kind of triathlon activity or running races? I mean, is this something that you see as a really big part of your extracurricular life?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to keep with it. And now that I know how fun a triathlon is, I'm planning to do more. I already just signed up for one. September 20th will be my second triathlon. And then next year I want to repeat the Iron Girl and perhaps maybe some longer ones.
Wow. Do you do strength training as well? Is that an important piece, do you think, for most people?
I think it is an important piece. I don't do it nearly as much as I should, though. For me, that's not quite as fun as getting out there running or playing soccer, but it's definitely important as an athlete to have muscles to support your endurance. So it's something I try to work on.
What did you do specifically to get ready for the Iron Girl? It sounds like you had, the running was kind of natural, the biking was natural. Tell us a little bit more about the training regimen you set up, though, or how someone might approach that kind of a training regimen.
I guess it depends on where your strengths and weaknesses are. For me, my weakness was the swim, so I started going to the pool at the CAB almost every
day.
That's
the campus activities building here at Upstate Medical University, right?
Yep, correct. So I had no former training in swimming, so the best I could do was try to watch some videos online. They're pretty helpful finding form and technique because I had no idea of the proper form even.
So you literally learned how to swim by watching videos.
Yes.
that's pretty impressive.
It was definitely helpful. I could see a coach that knew what they were doing might even be more beneficial because they can watch you and tell you what you're doing wrong. But for the time I had, the resources I had, it helped a lot to watch those videos and go to the pool and try to implement those techniques.
So you did that, and did you continue? What was your running regimen during that time to get ready?
I ran about the same that I normally do. It was just a 5K in the Iron Girl, so it wasn't anything longer than I was prepared for. So my running training was about the same.
So take us through the day of the race. I mean, what exactly, where were your challenges? What did it feel like? Take us through. What was it like? You started out with the hardest part. Was that actually a good thing to kind of get through the part that was most difficult?
In retrospect, I think it was nice to get that done and out of the way. I was super nervous leading up to it. I couldn't sleep the night before, and then standing about shin deep in water waiting for the horn to go off for us to start, my stomach was turning. But as soon as I got in that water and started going, it was hard at first. There's so many people right there, so you're getting splashed and kicked. But once you kind of spread out, I forgot that almost that I was in a race per se. I didn't have the nerves quite as hard, and I just swam. I did what I do in the pool every day. And then once I got out of the water, I was like, okay, I can do this. Biking and running, no problem.
So by then you were kind of over the hump, so to speak?
Yes, that's over the challenge, I think.
Did you have any sense that you were ahead? At what point did you realize that you were doing so well? I mean, that you'd left the field behind?
I really didn't have any idea. It was kind of hard because they send people off in waves based on your age group. I was in the last wave, so there was tons of people in front of me. I didn't know who was in my wave versus who was in waves before me.
I see.
It goes on net time. So I passed a lot of people on the bike and run both, but I didn't know where I stood as far as net time.
So it was a little bit like personal best in a sense. I mean, you were doing the very best you could, and then that net time was added up, and that's where you fell.
Exactly.
Wow. Well, in some ways, that's a very interesting way to run a race, rather than having people kind of nipping at your heels kind of thing. You're really working against yourself, so to speak, or with yourself.
Yeah.
Very cool. So what were the best parts of the whole thing? What did it feel like when you kind of got to the finish line and finished?
My biggest memory about the finish line is just about 100 meters before, there was a big group of females ahead of me, and there was a volunteer that saw me kind of trying to go a little faster, so he yelled to me, "Catch them all," and that really just gave me the encouragement to sprint, and sure enough, I caught them all right at the finish, so.
Incredible. Well, it's such a great story, and I want to thank you so much for coming in. In the little bit of time we have left, what advice would you give to somebody who's considering this kind of an experience?
I'd say go for it. Do what you can. There's going to be people there to help you make it. And doesn't matter if you're first or last. If you finish, that's great.
The finish is the point.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Heather. My guest has been Heather Nelson. She's a graduate student in the School of Cell and Developmental Biology at Upstate Medical University and a close to winner, a fourth place in the Iron Girl, sixth annual Iron Girl Triathlon event here in Syracuse. Thanks again for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is registered dietitian Maureen Franklin with Healthy Eats. In this week's segment, I'll be talking about the new proposals to our food labels. How many times do you look at a food label? What do you look for? Calories? Carbohydrates? Fats? Sodium? Or are you so confused you've given up looking at labels? The FDA is proposing to update the Nutrition Facts label to reflect new public health and scientific information, including evidence on nutrition, obesity, and chronic disease. In 1990, when the FDA started requiring nutrition labeling on foods, the objective was to reduce consumer confusion about labels, help consumers make better food choices, and encourage manufacturers to improve the nutrition profile of foods. The food label has not changed significantly since that time. In 2006, trans fats was added to the list of required nutrients. The proposed changes can be grouped into three categories. Number one, changes based on new nutrition science. Number two, updates serving size requirements. And number three, a refresh design. In regards to number one, new nutrition science, a few of the proposed changes are, number one, requiring the declaration of added sugars on the label. Number two, removing the requirement for declaring calories from fat. And number three, requiring vitamin D and potassium. In regards to number two, updates on serving size requirements, the FDA is updating the reference values used by manufacturers to set serving sizes to make them more realistic and to reflect what people really eat and drink. In regards to number three, the refresh design, a few of the proposed changes are, number one, highlighting the caloric content of foods by increasing the type, size, and placing in bold type the number of calories and servings per container. Number two, changing amount per serving to amount per blank, with the blank filled in with common household measurements. Number three, removing the existing footnote that describes the daily value for 2,000 and 2,500 calories. There is a lot more information on the proposed changes, and you can read more at www.fda.gov. Go to the fact sheets and look for the new proposed nutrition labels fact sheet. This has been Maureen Franklin, registered dietitian, with your serving of Healthy Eats.
Coming up next, what you need to know about bullying. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Back to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of September 8th. Stop and smell the rosemary. It can be hard to justify taking time out of our busy schedules to enjoy a meal. Still, eating slowly can help you eat less, learn to recognize when you're full, and cause you to feel more satisfied. Taking your time also allows you to enjoy food in a whole new way, experiencing the sights, smells, and tastes that go along with it. This week, set aside at least 20 to 30 minutes for each meal, and don't multitask by watching TV, checking emails, or talking on the phone. Consider the flavor of each bite, and take time during the meal to think about your fullness level. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Bullying can happen anywhere, face-to-face, through text messages, or more recently, on the web. And it's not limited by age, gender, education level, or neighborhood. And it can cause lasting harm, especially to the developing child or teen. But what can parents, grandparents, or other caring adults do when in the face of this destructive behavior? Here with some answers is Dr. Joseph Nima. He's assistant professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University and attending physician in pediatrics at University Pediatrics and Adolescence Center. Welcome, Dr. Nima. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Linda. It's nice to be here.
So let's begin by defining, what do we mean when we say bullying?
So I think the general definition for bullying has three major components, if you want to be able to identify it clearly. One is that the person that's doing the bullying has an intent to harm the person that they're bullying. That's different than some other types of interactions between individuals. The second is that there tends to be an imbalance of power between the individuals who are being bullied and the bullier. So the person doing the bullying is in a higher position of power. And the third is that the bullying tends to be a repetitive action, something that happens over and over again. Although I think it's important to note that that's part of the common definition of it, but there's probably times when an event is severe enough or significant enough, where even once or twice of a certain event happening, somebody might look at that and say, you know, that's bullying and needs to be addressed.
Now, there's obviously different types of bullying. I alluded to it can happen anywhere in a lot of different circumstances. So what are the types that, you know, you see that we can characterize?
Yeah, so there are a few different ways that bullying can take place. One is what people picture on TV shows and things like that, where people are either being threatened physically and either being hit or pushed or shoved in, for instance, the hallways at school.
Or into the locker.
Yeah, exactly. The classic picture that people have in their heads. And certainly verbal bullying is another source of that. So people making fun of people or isolating people from groups or trying to break up friendships.
Name-calling.
Name-calling is a classic example, yeah. And I think that spreading rumors and things like that is another form of bullying that's extremely important and may not go immediately recognized. So slandering people and then having the consequences of that trickle down. And then, as you mentioned before, cyberbullying is becoming an increasing problem and something that people are paying more attention to.
Especially with everyone today, so many kids have phones, mm-hmm. smartphones.
Yep.
So they have access to the internet. They have access to all of those social networking sites and can be doing this day long, you know, all day long.
Yeah. Yeah, cyberbullying certainly a problem. Kids have access to Facebook and Instagram and other things like that basically 24 hours a day. And so if you're a bullier, you have a consistent source of being able to perform the act of bullying, even if you're not physically in the presence of the person you're trying to intimidate.
I mean, sometimes we seem to focus on bullying as happening only to kids. The truth of the matter is bullying takes place all through the lifespan. I mean, people in work circumstances and all, you know, we may call it something else. We may call it harassment.
Yeah, or intimidation.
Right.
Like that, yeah.
But all of those things really, they do exist. But what we're focusing today is more on the developing child or teen, because that kind of impact can have lifelong effects on the person, even if the bullying goes away at some point.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's a lot of long-term complications that should be considered when you're going to address this problem. You know, kids can have problems of depression and anxiety as a result of being bullied. They can have increased feelings of sadness and loneliness, things like that. They may not sleep well as a result of it. They may have poor school performance. And in the extreme, there are kids who take their lives as a result of being bullied and commit suicide.
That's been the highest profile. I sometimes think there's been a higher incidence of bullying, but I think what I'm seeing more is a higher awareness of the fact that bullying exists to the degree, because we've seen, especially in our 24/7 news cycle, we've seen incidents of kids really taking their own lives after some kind of a bullying episode.
Yeah,
so it's become much more a part of our consciousness, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that social media plays a role in that as well, as far as people airing grievances online and saying things on Facebook, or you know, sending messages to each other and posting things about bullying, whether it's from one side or the other. So I think it's more visible. It's hard to know whether the incidence is actually on the rise, but I certainly think that it's safe to say that people are looking at it more often and more aware of it happening.
You know, it's interesting. We always talk about the effects, and we have just talked about the effects of the people who are bullied, but there are effects on the people who bully others as well, it seems to me, and in the sense that we see certain behaviors in people who tend to bully.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I don't want to victimize the people who are doing the bullying too much, because I think that they're in a position that requires attention and discipline. But at the same point, there is some pathology there that needs to be specifically addressed. Those kids tend to be, in general, more aggressive, more concerned about their social appearance, you know, more concerned about their popularity. They may not care very much about other people, as opposed to the kids who are being bullied, who tend to be more introspective and more concerned for others.
So there may be almost a desensitization to people's feelings.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see that in more severe forms and things like conduct disorder, which is a diagnosable psychiatric condition. But I think children exhibit symptoms that are consistent with that, even if they don't fit the diagnostic criterion at times.
If you're just joining us or listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, I'm Linda Cohen here with pediatrician Dr. Joseph Nima, and we're talking about bullying. So who do you think is most at risk? I mean, it seems obvious, but for being bullied, I mean, who are the kids that get picked on?
Yeah, as you mentioned before, I think it's important to remember that anybody can be bullied, whether it's a kid at school or in a workplace. But there do tend to be some specific characteristics of the kids that are. And those kids tend to be a little more introverted. They might be more shy. They may lack self-confidence. And certainly, I think that those children are ones who sometimes lack social support networks. They may not be well supported at home or have a teacher that they can confide in. They may not have a counselor or a healthcare professional that they trust enough to tell these things to. And I've heard many stories of kids who have been bullied for prolonged periods of time who fit those characteristics, and then eventually, after months, will finally seek out an adult and say, you know, this has been happening to me, but I was too afraid to say anything about it.
And I would also think kids who have some disability, even in our supposed world of you know, mainstreaming and accepting kids with all kinds of levels of skill and abilities, it seems to me those kids also can be take the brunt of that kind of behavior.
Yeah, I think that another way of saying that is that Anybody who sees themselves in a minority position may be vulnerable to bullying, and not minority in the classic definition of the word, but for instance, kids who see their sexual preference as different than others, kids who see their gender identity as different than others, their religious practices perhaps, anything that they may look at and say, you know, this makes me atypical compared to other children, I think those kids tend to start to become in a position where they can be bullied as a result of feeling isolated.
You know, you were talking before about the kids who are at risk for bullying others. Obviously, they are also in need of some attention and help. And so it strikes me that one needs to begin to understand the dynamics of what brings somebody to that place in life, too.
Like yeah, it is important. Like I said before, there is, I think, some degree of pathology there for sure. There are studies that show that those children who do bullying more often, not the ones who are bullied, but actually do the bullying, that those people are more likely to go on to have felony charges and convictions, drug and alcohol abuse, physical abuse in their own homes later in life. So it's not a benign process to be the bullier.
And it seems like it's suggestive that people need to be on the lookout for those kids as being needy as well. I'm not saying it's a cry for help when they do it, but in some ways it's an indicator that they do need help.
Yeah, I think that's exactly correct. And that's why you have to address both sides of it when you're trying to fix the problem. You can't just assume that you're going to get a kid who's bullied some help and that fixes things. You need to bring the bullier to the forefront and address those issues as well in whatever way you think you need to.
What are the warning signs for parents? I mean, to me, obviously, before you can intervene or know to do anything, what should you be looking out for as a parent if you have the concern or suspicion? Let's say your kid doesn't come to you, but your kid may fall into that category of quote-unquote perceived minority, as you've articulately pointed out. What should you be looking for?
Well, I think there's a lot of small, minor details in a kid's life that can perhaps indicate that they're being bullied. I think to start off, it's important to just be able to be a parent at home that says, how was your day today, kiddo? You know, asking them a general question about how things are going may allow them to feel at ease to open up and tell you about things that are problems in their life. But sometimes that won't work and they still might not talk to you about things. So I think there's a list of and certainly this list is exhaustive, but I think there's some specific qualities that kids show that may indicate that bullying is a problem. Things like, you know, coming home with missing clothing or, you know, you didn't or, you know, being beat up at school if you came home with a black eye. That's the obvious one. But things like, what if they come home hungry every day? Maybe their lunch money is being stolen. Sorry. Maybe they are hurting themselves in some way. Maybe they're becoming reclusive. Maybe they're avoiding certain social situations.
How about somatic complaints? If you're talking about a lot of headaches or stomach aches or not really comfortable going to school or going certain places.
Yeah, exactly. Symptoms of school phobia is another huge one. So kids that are avoiding certain social situations may be simply trying to avoid a specific person. And it may not be readily apparent unless you're asking those questions. Why are you feeling that way? Why don't you want to go to those places? And yeah, kids that have recurrent headaches and belly pain and things like that may just be exhibiting symptoms of school phobia.
And I would think you as a pediatrician might be the first line of defense in seeing some of that, especially in a teen, where that might not happen, you know, even with a younger child as well, but those kinds of somatic complaints.
Yeah, I think being on the lookout for those things is extraordinarily important for caregivers.
So what should parents, adults, any caring adult, whether they be a teacher, you know, what should we do? What needs to be done?
I think it's important to remember that this is a difficult issue to address at times. There are some basic tenets that people will recommend, like looking the bully in the eye when you're being intimidated, talk in a firm voice, walk away, don't get into an altercation with them, seek out an adult. Those are all well and good, and I think sometimes, rarely, they may work well, and other times they may fail completely, and if you are doing those things, you still may be bullied. So then I think safety has to become a major priority. Protect yourself, seek an adult immediately, and if this is really progressing in a way that's bad, you have to have the courage to go to an adult and say that it's a big problem and try to get it addressed. And lastly, I think it's important to remember that if you're a bystander to bullying, this is an enormous responsibility and something that's not easy to take on if you're another kid. But having the courage to go to an adult and say, you know, this kid is really being affected by bullying is a huge stance to take and can really benefit a kid enormously.
So the key point is, if you're talking to your child, your grandchild, a child that you know or a teen that you know, and you have the sense they're being bullied, you want to give them the belief that, first of all, it's to be proud of who they are, mm-hmm. and it's not because of who they are, but it's the other person's problem. But then what are the safety is a crucial issue. And then also to be able to stand up for yourself if you can, but to go get help.
Yeah, that's always absolutely right.
Go get help.
It's certainly not the kid's fault that's being bullied. And that's a huge important point to remember.
Yeah, not to blame the victim.
Exactly.
And also it could be in some circumstances a true civil rights violation, and that the schools or wherever this is taking place need to be apprised of that and looking out for this kind of problem.
Yeah, the Dignities for All Students Act was something passed a couple of years ago that mandates that schools report bullying in certain situations. And so there are potential legal ramifications if schools don't follow those protocols.
And very lastly, when we talk about cyberbullying, what recommendations do you say to parents in terms of, you know, social media monitoring? What would you say?
Yeah, I think parents have to have an open dialogue with their kids about their social media use. There are privacy settings that can be altered. There is monitoring of what's going on social media that maybe parents wouldn't otherwise be aware of. And so just talking to your kids about what's going on their social media platforms and then addressing issues as they come up is extremely important.
I'll just give you an anecdote. I know of one father who says to his kids, and he's very technologically sophisticated, I'm going on every month and checking all of your communications, putting them on notice that they are being monitored.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's one person's approach.
Well, I think having that kind of involvement is important. A 13 or 14-year-old with a Facebook account is certainly a vulnerable kid in a certain situation. So having parental monitoring is hugely important.
Well, thank you so much. This has been very enlightening and very, very helpful. My guest has been Dr. Joseph Nima. He's assistant professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for coming in.
It was very nice to be here.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. We tell our medical and nursing students to remember that the medical story they are trying to figure out from each patient sitting before them can be further illuminated by listening to the patient tell his or her story in their own words. Robin Nagowski was a medical student when she wrote the poem Anybody Listening, which gives us the same story from these two different perspectives. Anybody listening? I pour myself another cup of coffee, wishing it were 7 and I could go home. The coffee maker sizzles and burns the bottom of the pot as I slide it back. I stand there, stealing a few more minutes, letting the sound soothe me. I try not to think about the last patient I saw. He didn't speak English, the third today. It takes so much energy to understand them, while the time clicks, forcing me forward, reminding me there's never enough. What's the point? I walk back to the nurse's station. My coffee sloshes in the styrofoam cup. I don't even try to stop the spilling. As I walk past the patients, I see a familiar face, though it's certainly not familiar to him anymore. I know I will be seeing him next, and I prepare for battle. I take him to the last room in the hall. The isolation might support intimacy and trust. I need him to trust me. You need to let me help you, I tell him. Stay here so we can help you. I stare at his jaw, almost disgusted. I can't imagine why he waited so long. Why didn't you listen last time? I know before he stutters that he isn't going to stay. They never do. They come to me for help, then don't let me. I hand back his loose papers and soiled vanilla envelope, knowing that the belongings he offered will not help me convince him to stay. I ask him to come back tomorrow for treatment to begin, then I turn away. He won't return. He's done this before. I take another coffee in defeat, and the bitter taste warms me. I close my eyes, count to 10, then walk back through dingy white hallways, past patients lined up in anticipation, into Section B. I take the next patient. 2. I don't know why I chose to come here today. To delay further, I smoke a cigarette. Maybe this will be my last. I smoke another. Inside, I need something to do with my hands. It would help pass the time. Eternity is not the word I would choose, but when my name is called, I long for it. I know there's something wrong and has been. I can't look at myself in the mirror. They talk to me, ask some questions, then point me toward another piece of the maze. Again, I wait. Time clicks. I fidget, not out of worry or fear, but out of need. I hear my name. He takes me to a room, far away in the shadows of the hall. Is it easier to look at me here? He talks. I think he's trying to help, but I can't stay here. No one would be able to take care of Mac, I tell him. I show him a picture. I think he saw it. He must have. I can't stay here. I don't know what you want to do, but I have to go home to Mac. I need him. I go outside again to breathe fresher air. I light up, and the taste warms me. I reach for my jaw habit and remember what it used to feel like. Even if I stay here, I doubt it would ever be the same. I told that nice man I would return tomorrow for more tests. I think that's what he wanted. I know he doesn't expect to see me. I've done this to him before, and others. But I can still breathe. I have Mac. I can't lose him because of this. What's the point? I walk along East Bailey Street, 3 more blocks, 20 more minutes if the bus is on time. Then I'm home. Just me and Mac.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we take a look at concussions and all you need to know to protect your student athlete. Plus, we'll have more on the Ebola epidemic and the controversial work of Dr. Thomas Saz, a local psychiatrist. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.